Thanks, man.
I'm John Shires. I'm an alcoholic.
John.
It's a real privilege to be able to introduce the speaker tonight. John is a sponsor of mine, and I love him dearly. And there are very few people that I have sponsored who I was less hopeful for their long-term sobriety than John. And that's the God's honest truth. And other members of the home group would attest to that. But we love him, and he's made an incredible recovery. He's a good AA member. He sponsors a lot of guys. He's always doing service work. He's very involved. He's a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I look forward to hearing his story tonight. Come on up, man.
Hey. I'm John Corey. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John. Hey, John.
Let's see. I have a sponsor. I sponsor other guys. My sobriety date is September 24th of 2012. It's not the first sobriety date I've had. Who here has had a sobriety date like prior to the one you have now? It's like half, huh? Yeah. Me too. That's been my story. So it's kind of funny. Every time I talk about that, like my sobriety date is, I remember, yeah, but it was. Oh, and before that it was. And, you know, there were like some other dates and like, what makes you think this is any different, bro? You know, it's kind of the thought that I have and I don't know. I don't know. Like, there's this thing we have here in our culture in AA, like, never drink again. That's success, right? Like, I'll never drink again. It even says in the big book, there's these stories. He went on to never drink again, and that's like some kind of badge of honor or success or whatever. That's like the holy grail of, like, doing it right in AA. I didn't have that. I've blown it twice. What I know about alcoholism is that we always drink again, and it seems like the further I go, the narrower the road gets, and like the harder it is, you know. Or somehow, there's more is required. So let's see. I was born here in Georgia to pretty, fairly normal for the early 70s. Kind of Georgia Southern, real traditional parents. They were really young when I was born. I think my mom was about 20. My dad was like 23. They were poor, hadn't figured out what to do yet. My dad was kind of this idealist who his father had been a real successful Baptist preacher at this big institutional Baptist church in Augusta, Georgia. I think my father fancied himself a preacher and somehow got this little church to hire him as the preacher, and that's what his job was when we were born. I think there were like 12 people that went to church there, and they lived in this little like cinder block one bedroom shack. And then I was born, and it was fairly unremarkable. I had a fairly typical little early childhood. I remember, like, there's this thing that happened that seems relevant to everything that happened after that, like this, which I would characterize as this slide into kind of like insanity and eventually alcoholism, where I started reading early, like earlier than the other kids, and my parents, or my mom especially, and like her family members were so impressed by I caught wind of how like that meant something, you know, and would hear like these hushed conversations about like John, and we have to get him tested. And then I went and got like tested at this place, and he's special. And there were all these like kind of things said about like just about me, and that I was special and different and unique, and like read better than the other kids and was probably smarter than them. And I was 6 or 7 when this happened, and that idea was given to me. And I don't know if my being an alcoholic has anything to do with it, but man, I grabbed that idea and held on to it for dear life, and just like got really, really attached to the idea of being smarter than you, better than you, and different than you, like from a very early age. And remember also being like really kind of lonely and feeling fairly ostracized, even though there was nothing factual to really like back that. I mean, I had like friends and played with people and got invited to the birthday parties, and but always felt kind of like out from people, and like there was something I had to do to impress you that I was like good and cool somehow, and that always came out in these just like surprising, like, oh my god, why did he just say that kind of like things, you know, often with me being sent home from whatever it was that we were doing, and with people coming and telling me that their fathers had told them that they're not allowed to play with me anymore, or things like that. Kind of self-conscious, I guess. We moved a few times. I never really lived anywhere long enough to get like really attached to anybody or have any kind of like have an answer to anyone. You know, we're going to move in a couple of years, it seemed like, and whatever lies I tell you to impress you with like how things are, that won't catch up to me because like we'll probably like live somewhere else. It's kind of a fact of life. My parents split up when I was about 13. I'm presently the divorced father of three daughters, and there's been like a big churn of like guilt and regret, and oh my god, I've screwed up my kids, kind of like thinking that has come from that, and they have seen some counselors, and in those conversations, I've revealed that my experience with this was the day that it was announced to us that like we're getting divorced. It was like one of the happiest days of my childhood. I was ecstatic. It was like, oh my god, this probably means we'll live with mom, and you won't be around anymore. Ha ha, win. It was like this huge win. And then like 6 months later, we meet our coked up stepfather to be one night. I didn't know, I had no frame of reference for, I mean, you know, I had seen Miami Vice, but like there were no Ferraris in the driveway or whatever. So I didn't really have a reference for that until later, like after some things had happened to make it clear that that's what was going on. But I remember the first night I met this guy, and he was definitely like high as a kite. And off we went to California, where he was in the Army and had like marching orders to go to a different Army base. So I'm like 15 years old and you know, about to start ninth grade, and we just moved to Monterey, California, and I'm this little like country hick kid who just moved here from Dahlonega, Georgia, and that was where I lost my southern accent and just like, man, you're in puberty and just got dropped in California, man, you were not talking like that anymore. Learn a new voice fast, and I think it happened in like 2 days. Gosh, that's another like fairly alcoholic tendency that I have. You know, you put me somewhere where like there's something to do to fit in with like the other people, and I'll do it without even thinking about it. It's like completely unconscious, not even really a thought. We moved to Athens, Georgia, when he went to prison. It was about a year. It was about a year later. He was kind of a drunk, and my mom kind of got drunk after she and my dad split up. My dad was like this real fundamentalist, like hardcore Baptist, like, you know, preacher guy, and really, really like just harsh. He was also like really angry and really afraid and really insecure and really just kind of like small-minded, and real afraid. Always like flipping out and like losing it over stuff, throwing furniture and like breaking chairs and stuff. When he and my mom split up, it was, my mom has talked about this later, and it was like she felt like she had like finally gotten free or whatever, and I remember she started drinking like wine and scotch after that. And she's this little woman who, like, has never, from the beginning, been able to handle her liquor well at all. I remember her picking me up at the skating rink one night with some girl that we had to drive home, and I'm, like, obsessed with the thought that I might kiss this girl in the back of the car. It's all dark, and we're, like, in the back seat in one of those big 70s cars, like, way back in the back, you know? And then, like, never mind all that. Like, we're about to run off the road. I mean, like, I've heard gravel under the wheels, like, four times. And my mom was, like, wasted driving us home. I do remember that. That was, like, real shortly after she and my dad split up. And scotch became, like, her thing after that. And then later I would, like, steal cigarettes from her. And the Army guy, he was a drinker. And I couldn't stand him. He was this golf playing, sports watching, like Army Ranger parachuter guy, with this like military haircut and like all these muscles and like, you know, plaques. All these I love me plaques on the wall. And his about the time that he like, you know, went to Panama or whatever. And I remember it kind of connecting that like. That equals Budweiser. Like, Budweiser is like, that is it. It's like a big truck and a dude like that. Man, I don't ever want that at all. Like, that is not for me. Whatever that is, it's not, like, my thing at all. Never going to do that. We moved to Athens. It's a college town. There are lots of, like, kids around my age who have pot. We smoke pot. We don't get stoned on pot because it's bad pot and we don't know what we're doing, but we smoke it and act like we got stoned and like laugh. And I meet a friend. He drinks. I meet other friends. They eat pills. And they introduce me to this, like, world of possibilities. One of them gave me a hit of LSD for $4. It cost $4 to trip on acid in 1988. And it lasted all day long, like forever, you know? Mind-blowing experience. The next day, I'm, like, on the phone calling him back to find out, when can we do that again? Like, can you come by? Like, I want to get more. My mom hears me on the phone and flips out. And she's flipping out, and I'm seeking attention. And this, like, kind of, like, these two things mix and flare up, and I wind up at this rehab hospital for an intake evaluation. And I don't know if you ever really go to an intake evaluation and leave. I think those things are designed to pretty much keep you there, like, pretty much no matter what, you know. I don't think it matters what questions you give to the answers. But anyway, here I am, 15 years old. I've smoked some pot, not gotten stoned. I've tripped on acid once. And they give me my first big book. Tell me I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, and off we go to an AA meeting and my new room and my roommate. God, that was crazy. So I wound up being introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous before I had a drink of alcohol. And I angled for, like, hey, I really don't think, like, this is the wing I belong in. I mean, admittedly, I've got some problems. Yeah, maybe I'm angry. Okay, yeah, okay. I mean, I get the alarm over the using drugs and all, but it was one time. I mean, I really, perhaps, you know, maybe there's a better place for me. And no, that was characterized as one of my alcoholic con games by this, like, by this some counselor. God, I still have a resentment about that. I just remember this Dave guy who worked at Charter Winds in 1988 and, like, just his smug face about all that. I did my 30 days there and got out and had no interest in really, like, I don't know, I'm not one of you. I'm a kid who, like, got caught up in this thing. I mean, whatever. But my job, I have to go to meetings now. And it was like, if you go to these meetings, then you can, like, use the car. So it's like, all right, what are you going to do? I go to the meetings. The meetings are a place where I can smoke cigarettes openly without anybody, like, giving me grief about it. Hey, that's cool. There are seemingly loose women at these meetings who hug me and find me charming and want to, like, talk to me and stuff. That's all right. I mean, that's this. And this is my 16-year-old perception of all of this, and it seemed like, okay, I mean, I'll do this for a little while. This is kind of like, this is all right. I mean, not bad. This is better than what the other 10th graders are doing. So I did, and that didn't last long. I can't remember what happened, but I'm sure there was a girl involved in, like, and drinking, and somebody offered me a drink, and I drank it, and I remember the first time that I had, like, three beers. I had three Budweiser beers. That thing about the Budweisers, whatever. I had met rock and roll people by now, and they were drinking Budweiser beers. And, like, all right. So I had three Budweiser beers, and I got the three-beer buzz. And it was the first time I had ever, like, experienced the effects of alcohol. And it was absolutely perfect. It was absolutely perfect. I remember saying out loud, we have to do this all the time, and, like, this is how to do it. This is all you have. You just do this. And I think it was, like, by the end of that week that it was like, well, I mean, the three-beer buzz, yeah, but you have to, like, you have to keep the three-beer buzz going because it fades fairly quickly, you know, and you have to, like, maintain the three-beer buzz. So you drink the three beers, and then you maintain the buzz by drinking more beers. Not quickly. Because then you would get, like, a four-beer buzz. That's not, you don't want that. You just drink steadily to, like, maintain the buzz. And that's, in hindsight, I recognize that as pretty alcoholic thinking. And that was, like, that was the first week that I drank. And my goal was to do it just like that. And I think it worked out, like, twice. Like, two times that week, I think it happened. By the end of that summer, I had convinced an adult who I drank with. I'm like 16, 17 years old drinking with adults. God, that's another story. But I had convinced my friend Warren that, like, we should find cocaine because then we'd be able to, like, stay up all night on New Year's Eve at the New Year's Eve party and just drink, like, without ever passing out. And he was a good sport and, like, produced cocaine and gave it to 17-year-old me. And in that moment, there was this thing that just got seared onto my, like, brain and consciousness, and it's still there. And it's this equation, like, beer plus me plus cocaine equals just this outrageously amazing good time with incredibly sexy rock star women who want me, and music and, like, lights and being the center of attention without ever making a fool of myself. And that's, like, that's the equation, and that just got stamped on my brain and never left. It, like, it never came off my brain after getting tattooed there or whatever that night. I had that experience one time. I never had that experience again, ever. But it didn't matter because it was, like, it was tattooed on my mind somewhere that, like, that's the recipe. Do that again, and I tried. Eventually, like, I do what I always do, and I just drink all the time. I get fired from jobs. I don't care about going to work. I just want to drink. I go to your party and hang out by your keg and just drink, and then the next night go to the next one. I never have any money. It's kind of okay in a college town. I mean, there's just always beer, and, like, there's always drugs being passed around and drinks to have, and, you know, you do what you have to do, and you wind up wasted all the time, and it's not really a big deal. Then I had to leave Athens because of, like, cops and this stripper girl named Cheryl who thought I should marry her, and went to New Orleans, and I had been on a trip to New Orleans and experienced, like, drinking in the French Quarter, and it's like, I gotta go there. Like, that's where I have to go, and I went and got a job in a diner working the graveyard shift. I think that's why I survived my 10 months in New Orleans, because I was at work between 11 and 7 every night. When I could have gotten, I did my drinking between, like, 7 a.m. and 2 p.m. And, you know, if you're going to kill yourself drinking in New Orleans, it's probably not going to be between 7 and 2. So I've, like, dodged a bullet there. still managed to like get plenty drunk. And by the time I had this girlfriend too, I met this girl. I fell in love with this woman, Simone. She was like young and beautiful, like just incredibly gorgeous. And nobody like her had ever liked me before. But she seemed to, and she didn't drink. She was in AA, and I told her about my like experience with this, and an eyebrow kind of went up, and then we went and did our little like 21-year-old we're in love thing, and when her brother showed up, her brother was like actually a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and when he showed up, he took one look at me and was like, "Oh my God, I know exactly what you need," I think the next night took me to an AA meeting. And by then, I needed to get sober. You know, I was kind of a mess. We went. By the end of that week, I had decided that I was going to work Mardi Gras and then move to Hawaii and go to Maui and join Kihei Morning Serenity and work the steps with this guy's sponsor, because like that's probably what I need. And Simone is like, "Yeah, that is probably what you need." And I was like, "Man, that's what I need. I really need that." And I was right. I mean, I really did need that. And I did. I left. I went to Maui. I went to Kihei Morning Serenity. I met David Every. I asked him to sponsor me. He did. We worked some steps. I remember reading a fifth step. I remember making amends. I like wrote checks. This kind of like 21-year-old checks you write where it's like for $40 or whatever, because that's like all I got right now. But I swear in 10 months I'll have paid back that whole $430-something that you gave me that one time. It's kind of like that. And then I wanted to move, so I moved. I moved over to the west side of the island. I worked at the Alano Club. It was kind of like Napa, only for tourists in Lahaina. And there's meetings there like 4 times a day, 5 times a day. I'm the resident manager. I sleep in this little shack out back, and I like work the counter at the daytime and sell Snapples and clean coffee pots, and I'm just sort of the person who's in charge of like this little clubhouse while all the AA groups have their meetings, and go to meetings all the time, like round the clock. We don't have cell phones. I'm not connected to my sponsor anymore. Why would you need to be with all these meetings I'm going to? I mean, like, we did all that. We did all that sponsorship step stuff. I mean, that's, like, done. We're good now. Now it's just, like, hang out and go to meetings. Love each other. That's what you do now. Go surfing. And so I did. I worked for 1 year, like concurrently. Like I got 1 year of longevity at a job as a cook at the Hard Rock Cafe in Lahaina, and thought, man, that's like, I can do anything. I mean, that's awesome. I had never had a job for more than about 5 weeks up until then. Like I worked there for a year. Went to all these meetings. I didn't continue. And then I wanted to move. Like, there was surf on the North Shore, and I could ride my bike to it. I wanted to move, and I did. And I think about that now, and I think about the guys that I sponsor, and I think about who I sponsor, and I think about, like, what it would be like to just decide, I'm going to move, and then do it. And not, like, talk to anybody, not have any conversations about it, not answer any questions about it, not, like, get any input from anyone at all, not weigh that, not consider it, just do what comes into my mind. And it's insane. Like, that is completely insane. It's what I did. And I was surrounded by all these AA people, and no one said, "Dude, that's insane. Have you talked to your sponsor about this?" Like, nobody said that. They were all like, "Yeah, sounds good. Probably should. They got meetings over there." They did. I didn't really go to them. 4 months later, maybe, somebody gives me a beer and I drink it. This guy from the church thing that I was doing, he could drink. And why can't I? God, Jesus loves you too. And so, yeah, I mean, it's true, I guess. I'll have one of those. And I did. And in short order, I was drinking the way that I always drink, which is pretty much like, how do I have to exist so that I can like drink all the time? Get up early, go to work so that I can get off early, get to happy hour by 3 o'clock where they have dollar margaritas until 7, and drink four hours worth of dollar margaritas every day. and then go home and smoke a bowl and like collapse and pass out and get up tomorrow morning at 5 o'clock and do it again. But it was okay because I rode my bike to and from work, and I was like getting exercise, and I was holding my job. And man, if you can get exercise and hold your job, why can't you drink as much as you want to? My world got really, really small. It was just like I go to work and I drink. It went like that for a couple of years, and I met this woman who took a look at me and thought, this is the guy for me. I later found out that she's nuts. I didn't know that then. I thought she was kind of, maybe I did think she was kind of nuts then, but I met a woman, and we started spending a lot of time together at her house, and going on trips and stuff, and she kind of elevated my lifestyle a little bit. I was now like drinking in some really kind of expensive places with like, nice drinks and stuff. I liked driving her car. And I went to work one day, and like it was after the Christmas break, and I go to work, and my boss, this guy who had kind of mentored me, I was the apprentice, had shot himself over the break, and I like came into work to find his body and like his brain on the wall, and it was like this real traumatic kind of thing. I recognize that now. At the time, I was like, oh God, that's like awful. I'm gonna need a day. I think I took a day, and then was like back to, all right, well, now what am I going to do? And what I came up with was, like, I got to quit drinking beer. I got to quit smoking weed. I got to marry this chick that I'm sleeping with. And, like, there's all these things wrong in my life, and I got to, like, set them right, man, because, like, that's not cool. People can die if you don't, like, do it right. I got to make all these things right. So I married the woman. I quit drinking for a couple of weeks, but, like, drinking comes back when you're me. And I think it was about a year later that, like, I couldn't stand this woman. I just don't know how much clearer to make it. I really did not like the woman. I could tolerate the woman drunk. I could not tolerate the woman, like, not drunk. So I drank. And she, you know, became increasingly uncomfortable with how I'm drinking. You know, she's around me all the time now, and like how I drink is to pretty much be drunk constantly so that I can tolerate you and not like just lose it. And then one night after like a handful of Valium and some bottles of red wine at her sister's little wine party, they're like glaring at me because it's time to go, and I'm like trying to open the other bottle of wine. And in the kitchen, when we're headed out the door, what are you doing? And I'm like, well, I mean, I can get one for the road. And I'm like, I'm barely standing up. And there's like all this stink eye and everything. And so in the car on the way home, I told her everything I thought about her. And none of it was nice. But all of it was true. Like, I was very honest. And I'm like 27, maybe. She's 10 years older than me. She's horrified. She's from this nice family where, like, everybody's nice. And their conversations are really deep when they're about, like, what pie we're going to have for dessert. And real shallow about everything else. And she's not ready for me at all. Like, not at all. And I don't know what I was doing there. It was crazy. It was this insane, self-centered, depraved, alcoholic insanity. Like, you're, like, uncomfortable and crazy. So go marry a woman who looks like she's kind of got her stuff together and that'll fix it. That's probably what that was. And anyway, the truth came out this one night, and I had to go back to AA the next day because if you drink like I drink, that's going to end. And I didn't want my marriage to end. Not because I was into the marriage, but because, like, the house and my car were, like, really attached to it. And, it's true. I mean, this is the truth of it. It's fairly gross, but it's true. I'm, like, 27. I'm married to a woman I can't stand. My life is, like, real wound up in all of that stuff. And, like, we're going to Telluride this winter. And, I mean, I can't, like, lose all this. Never mind, like, how am I going to look if I'm, like, divorced at 27, you know, what a loser. My dad's not going to be impressed with this at all. You know, I don't want to have that conversation with my parents. I don't want to have that conversation with anybody. You know, getting divorced because you're a drunk reflects poorly on you. You can't do that. So I went to an AA meeting. There was somebody there that I knew. They let me make coffee and clean the ashtrays. And I did. And it was a 7 a.m. home group meeting, Makawao Sunrise in Makawao, Maui, up country. Real pretty. It was this little rural church on the hill looking out over the valley. It was beautiful. And I rode my bike up there three mornings a week at 7 o'clock and posed as an AA member. I did, like, service, and I chaired the meeting sometimes. And I got a book, I think, and I might have read some of it. There were a few times that I thought, maybe I should ask that guy to sponsor me. He's kind of cool. And it's like, nah, I'm not. I mean, there was this one time, this guy that I had met before, he was friends with Shaylin, the guy that had in New Orleans who had taken me to a meeting. They were friends. I mean, those guys were walking the broad highway. Like, I know that now. I think I probably knew it then, but I know that now. And Bill Amling, he sat next to me at that meeting this one day and looked at me, and it was like, I hadn't seen him in a while, and he was like, "So you're married now, huh?" And I was like, "Yeah." It's like, God, how's that going? There must be a lot going on in all that, huh? And in my mind, I'm like, oh, dude, you have no idea, man. Like, my head was just so full of, like, judgment and rage and, like, anger. And I feel trapped. And, God, I hate her. And, like, but I got to keep it together and, like, be, like, nice. And because, like, we can't blow it, you know. And this is, that's how I live, like, 24/7 all the time. And this guy's like, there must be, like, something going on and all that, huh? You ever want to talk about it? And I was like, what are you talking about, man? It's fine. No. It's like letting this guy, that someone like smelled that on me and might out me as being the like insane person that I was like really terrifying to me. And I like just put on my like straight face and was like, dude, it's cool. I don't know what you're talking about. But I mean, I don't know, man, your experience might have been different. My marriage is great. And went on from there. I don't think I saw him again, but that chance encounter, that like 2-minute encounter I had with him before a meeting one time like 15 years ago, just I remember that, like, God, I remember it all the time. That's one of those things that I recall frequently and just think about how when you get some recovery in you and go through the thing that's in the steps and get to know your alcoholism, you can see it in other people too. And it's like really, really clear. It becomes like just crystal clear. And it seems like the more fifth steps I do with other people, not me, I did mine, but then since then I've done a bunch of these with other people. And it's like it just like wipes the crust off the glasses. You can see alcoholism. And that guy saw mine just really, really clear. And I wasn't trying to see it at all, but he saw it just crystal, you know, and tried to help, and I was not having it. Sober in AA, going to 3 meetings a week, probably like 2 years since I had a drink at that point, convinced that I am like 2 years sober man in AA. I don't know why, like, nobody's asked me to sponsor him, because, like, I've been here for like 2 years doing this stuff. I was fairly convinced, that my wife was a sick person. Sick. Oh my God. Like, not stupid or crazy anymore, because like I've got some big book language and it's sick now. but she's sick. And it turned into this just like kind of constant, I had a problem. And like a man, went and did something about it. Because that's what you do when you, like, you know, care. And wasn't afraid to look at myself. I don't know what I was thinking about at the time. Like, I hadn't looked at myself at all, and got terrified if you did. But in my mind, I like had this whole identity with the steps in AA and this conviction that I have like done this spiritual thing. This deep belief that that was true. And it was completely false. I mean, there was nothing true about it. And it's my narrative. And while I'm reciting it to myself, I'm like looking at this poor woman who married me going, "You, on the other hand, you never did anything. You never did anything. You just like sat there this whole time. Just sat there. Haven't changed at all. Haven't even like felt like you ought to. Same crazy sick person you always were. God." And it just built and it built. Never spoke about this to anyone until like God 5 years ago, and it just built like this pressure cooker kind of thing. And while it's building, I'm like doing some career stuff. We're having kids who like need things and cry all the time, you know, and like kind of get in the way of the lifestyle. I can tolerate like some really obnoxious things in life as long as I don't have to work too much and get to go windsurfing 3 hours every other day or whatever, and not much is required of me. Like, I can really tolerate some stuff. But when I gotta like work all the time, and we're like, it's been months since we had sex, and there's not any money and there's not any time, and my house is like this dumpy little house in Gainesville, Georgia, not like my little cottage in Haiku, Maui, my threshold for tolerating all of that stuff gets lower. I achieved this career thing. I decided again that I wanted a different career. I wanted to fly airplanes. So we moved to Georgia, and I like started doing all this training and flying airplanes and teaching people to fly and everything. I eventually got hired at an airline. And when I completed flight training at the airline, and they pinned my little brass wings on me to go make my $34,000 a year as an airline pilot, I drank. It was my birthday, and I had like a beer. I had a big glass of Sam Adams, and God, it was so good. I needed it so bad. And then I had another one, and it was even better, and God, and I stopped. I had like two beers and went home, you know, and slept the best I had slept in years. And that kind of continued for a while, and then I eventually like let her catch me, you know, and just kept drinking and drink the way that I eventually drink. It's always the same. I get to where like I just want to drink all the time. I'm like flying jets and drinking at night and getting up, perhaps still drunk. I don't know. I never like breathalyzed myself, but thank God nobody else did either, because I know that there were days that I reported for duty at 6 a.m. Not sober enough to safely like do much of anything, much less fly an airplane. And eventually like wanted not to do that anymore, because like this is getting in the way of my drinking. I'm like scared I'm gonna get caught all the time. Why don't we move? That's what we'll do. We'll move to New Mexico, where your parents are and where you grew up. You'll be fine. You'll finally like be okay if we just take you to like New Mexico Hippieville, where they do yoga the way you want to do yoga or whatever, and like, and then you'll be happy and get off my case about everything. So we did, and I just kind of checked out and like got drunk and stoned. There was this brief little window where I like tried to get sober and couldn't really, and then we had like the communication fight we needed to have, and she left and took the kids, and I went to the bar. When it was about 3 months later, I realized like the kids are in Georgia, I gotta go, and that was when I came here. I had been smoking like medical marijuana in these little foil packets with cellophane and like a lab report on it. It's amazing. It's like it is so good and clean, and like exactly how many percent of like all the difference. It's like the best pot ever. And they didn't have it in Atlanta when I got here, and it was like really disappointing because it was practically free in Santa Fe, but they did have cocaine, and it was like half price compared to the 80s, and it wasn't as good, but it was cheap, and it's all over the place. And I spent the next 6 months basically like just being the drunk that I had always wanted to be, and it was fairly epic. I no longer have a wife or any kids, and I've started drinking again, and it was on. And I lived like down in the East Atlanta Village and went and partied at the bar that the busboys and waitresses hung out at, and I'm like the oldest guy there. I was the creepy old guy at the club, and in my mind I was like the second coming of like Don Draper and Jay-Z. I had this BMW convertible that I bought, and I like drove it around and like tried to get myself killed or arrested every night, and failed wonderfully. And you know, that ran for about 6 months, and on September 24th, I woke up on a friend's couch, like, wasted from Jägermeister, still just knowing, I'm just done, just, like, done, and for real done, and knowing, like, I just can't do it anymore. I had a girlfriend, I had a married girlfriend who broke up with me. And it was like the day after I lost my job, my married girlfriend broke up with me. Wouldn't take my calls or anything, because like her husband threatened to take the kids and you'll never see him again if you ever talk to him again or something like that. And that was enough for me. It's so stupid now. It's like that job was like the worst job I ever had, and that girlfriend was the worst girlfriend I've ever had. But those two things, like losing those two things at the same time, indicated to me, man, whatever like drinking and cocaine you've been doing to make everything okay and to just make life work isn't enough, and it's going to take a lot more than that. I did not have it in me to do more than that. Like I was done. All right, I couldn't do it. I went to a bad AA meeting. I don't even know if it was an AA meeting. They had steps on the wall, and they read like something out of the Big Book. But that was there. It departed from Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know. It's funny. It was like it was really bad. But the act of going to it was a surrender in some way. It was a like, all right, I can't do this. I got to go get some help. There was no help to be had at this place. It was a bunch of old people talking about their problems was all it was. Nobody greeted me when I came in. Nobody tried to introduce. There's one guy who kind of made an attempt to sort of help me. But there was no help to be had at this place. But the act of just walking in the door was a surrender. After a couple of weeks, the guy who kind of seemed a little interested in this stuff, I just asked him, like, hey, I've been to AA before. This seems a little like different. Where are there any meetings that are kind of like a little more Big Book than this and kind of maybe harder core than like what we're doing here? And he directed me to the Fifth Tradition group, said, you might like that. And I went and I recognized like the AA that I had been introduced to before. And then I knew it was like Big Book oriented. Steps, lots of service positions, lots of people doing service, lots of people in the room, all these people like taking the podium. And it's funny because like at our Big Book study, you know, you like share from the podium. And so I would go to that meeting every other Thursday, because by now my girlfriend's like actually not going to get back together with her husband, so yeah, maybe we will do this. And she's got her kids every other Thursday, so on the off Thursdays when she doesn't have her kids, there's no way I'm going to an AA meeting on that night when I'm with her. But I'll come every other Thursday, and would hear like people talk about being a drunk like me and getting sober, and their tale of getting sober was unlike anything I had experienced in AA before. They all spoke with unanimity about the steps and sponsorship mostly sponsorship, but then the point of sponsorship is so I can do the steps, and then sponsoring others, and getting in service, and like joining a home group, and being in a home group, and this is like everybody across the board has the same message, and they're all like happy and like kind of put together somehow, you know. And after a couple of months of not getting well, just sort of like coming to this group and being mad at it for not like embracing me with open arms and saving me a seat at the table when we go to pizza and making me the chairperson or what, you know, it's like, I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't happening. And then it just kind of became clear, hey, if this stays like this, where you're just some like hanger on at the successful AA meeting where people are getting sober and they're like having this thing, but you're just like kind of a hanger on here, you'll drink. Like that's not gonna, like that experience won't keep you sober. You will be drunk again. Maybe not this month, maybe not even this year, but you'll drink again if it stays like that. And I knew that that was true and got scared. And asked this guy who seemed to be active if he would sponsor me. And I don't even know what that means. He seemed to be active was my impression of this guy. I didn't know him. I'd never spoken to him. I might have heard him share from the podium. He seemed to be active. And I asked him if he would sponsor me. And he said, yeah, and gave me some things to do. I began protesting. he didn't care and was just like, you know, do these things or don't. I mean, like, it's, dude, you're the one who wants help, you know, what are you? And so I started playing with these things, eventually got on board with, like, doing some of the things. And when I did, there were results that happened. And that was enough to, like, initiate a further surrender. Like, okay. I think the next one was, like, there was sponsorship. That was a surrender. You know, yeah, I'll like get a guy to help me. I'll tell him the truth about stuff. It's so hilarious. Telling the truth at the time was like vomiting all this insanity. That was, I would call him and just like, dude, you're never going to believe this. It's this insane like perception on like my crazy life at the time. And I thought, hey, that's like honest and therapeutic or whatever, you know. And, but it was a surrender. He demanded some things of me later, and I didn't want to go, eventually capitulate. It's a further like surrender. We did this inventory in a fifth step, and it's this further like surrender. And I keep saying that because what I find is like this whole thing is just like these layers of surrender. It's just like that's all that I wind up encountering next along the way. I'm at this real awkward like phase of this thing. I'll be sober 5 years in a couple of months, and from what I've seen, that's this real awkward, like everything's not new and awesome anymore. It's like kind of boring, and it's like the same old crap, really. And another sponsee who's not going to stay sober yet. You know, let's go throw my time at that some more. And I've been going through this kind of like, I don't know, it's just sort of disenchantment and disillusionment about some of this stuff through this like transition thing. But what I keep finding is that there is like this other layer of surrender after the thing that I get to, and that's very much at this place. Some things wonderful have happened. I can work again without like being kicked out of the workplace, which is really huge. I'm like actually worth something to the team that I work with. I met a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. She told her story this one night when I was at the home group, and I was in the throes of this like insane relationship. And as she like starts telling her story, I'm like, oh my God, she's not crazy. Like, I want one like that, man. That's like, that's what a woman's supposed to be like. Listen to her. She's like got some principles and stuff. Like, I want one with a spine like that. Oh my God. And I think I mentioned that to my sponsor, and he was like, you're out of your mind. Like, there's no way that's ever going to happen. Why don't you just like shut up and get back in these steps? And so he did. And then like by some miracle, like God saw fit to like work that all out. And that happened too. And she is amazing. Some of you know her, and she's an incredible woman who's been a fantastic helper to me on this voyage. I'll close with reading something. This is from A Vision for You. It may seem incredible that these men are to become happy, respected, and useful once more. How can they rise out of such misery, bad repute, and hopelessness? The practical answer is that since these things have happened among us, they can happen with you. Should you wish them above all else and be willing to make use of our experience, we are sure they will come. The age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. It's been an honor to be with you tonight. Thank you very much. All right.